Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to today's episode of the Middle Eastern Studies series at the New Books Network. My name is Deren Artash, and I will be your host for this episode. Today, we will be speaking with Ayfer Karakaya Stump, who is Associate Professor of History at the College of William and Mary. We will talk about her monograph, The Kızılbaş Alevis in Ottoman Anatolia, Sufism, Politics, and Community, published in December 2019 by Edinburgh University Press. Hello, Ayfer, and thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Deren. Thank you for having me.
Before we delve into the research process and the major findings of your work, could you briefly tell our uninitiated listeners about Kızılbaş Alevis? Who are they?
Yes, the Alevis, historically known as the Kızılbaş, are a little-known ethno-religious community, I should say, together with the kindred Bektashis, the Bektashi order, they make up around 15% of the population of Turkey. And there are also smaller pockets of related groups in neighboring countries, especially in the Balkans. While their liturgical language is primarily Turkish, as far as we know, there are among the Alevis also large numbers of Kurmanji, Kurdish, and Zazaki or Kurmanj speakers as well. I should also add here that the Alevis are sometimes mislabeled as the Turkish Shia in the media and even in some scholarly works. But that is not mislabeling, I guess, because not only do they not self-identify as Shia, but in many ways they also defy Shia normativity.
This is a point that you are also making in the conclusion of your book, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so in the conclusion, I briefly mentioned that my book is in part directed at the conception of Kızılbaşism or Alevism through the rubric of Shiism. More specifically, I push against the treatment of Kızılbaşism or Alevism as a reincarnation of what is called Gulat Shiism, that is associated with the initial party of Ali prior to Jafer al-Sadiq, Imam Jafer al-Sadiq. Now, of course, there are several important parallels and overlaps between various early Shia ideas and a number of Kızılbaş Alevi beliefs, starting with the centrality of Ali in Kızılbaş Alevi religious culture and devotional life. But my research shows that these elements within Alevism were mediated in large measure through Sufism. And we don't have any verifiable venues of transmission from the early Shia to the Kızılbaş milieu. And this stands in contrast to the case of the Nusayri Alawites, for instance. In their case, when we study their documents, their literature, then we can actually establish a direct a transmission between their tradition and, or we can trace their tradition to the inner circles of the 10th and the 11th Shi'i imams via specific historical figures. So I guess I want to underline this in part because of this whole problem of lumping together historically distinct groups into this one undifferentiated category of gulat.
This lumping together of Kızılbaşism with various different like ethnic and religious identities is something I imagine that we will talk about a lot in this episode, because your book really tries to disentangle some of these perhaps confused paradigms within the historiography. So in that vein, I want to ask about the sort of historiographical intervention that you are making into the paradigms through which Kızılbaşism has been viewed. So one of these, you say, treats Kızılbaşism as an undifferentiated strain within the hazy category of Turkish folk Islam, and the other sort of brackets Kızılbaşism with other popular religio-political movements that proliferated in the late medieval Irano-Turkic world. What would you say were the sort of political stakes that were generative of these paradigms and the problems that you identify with these frameworks?
Yes, great question. It's not an original insight to say that groups that do not conform to the majority pose a challenge to dominant religious and nationalist ideologies. And somehow these groups must be explained without validating their non-conforming religious beliefs or ethnic identities. So in regards to the first approach that you mentioned, that is more common in Turkish historiography, we can say that the treatment of Kızılbaşism or Alevism as an undifferentiated strain within the hazy category of Turkish folk Islam, that is supposed to be inherently syncretistic, by the way, fulfills a dual purpose. On the one hand, Alevism is thereby denied a distinctiveness and internal coherence and reduced to a decadent form of Islam. And on the other hand, it strategically co-opts this tradition or the Kızılbaş Alevi identity to Turkish nationalism, by, among other things, obscuring the existence of Kurdish and Zazaki Alevis. So it does, you know, many things all at once. And the other framework through which Kızılbaşism has been viewed in the historiography, as you said, and this one is more common in Iranian and Islamic studies, it involves the bracketing of Kızılbaşism with other popular religio-political movements that proliferated in the late medieval Irano-Turkic world. So these movements, again, they are all thrown into the same bag with little regard to their historical specificities, and they are viewed as sort of the reincarnation of some original Ur heresy, you know, the gulat. This is a historical approach, and is problematic because of that. And it is especially with its sort of externalistic take on these groups, is very very much reminiscent of medieval heresiographical literature. And ultimately, It serves to marginalize these dissentient groups in question as historical anomalies, if you will, and that thereby they are also rendered irrelevant for Islamic history, right? So so they are also marginalized in the historiography. Is my point? Yeah. So. Definitely there are high political stakes involved here in these two paradigms.
I'm hearing you say two things, and please correct me if I'm wrong. On the one hand, people try to claim Alevism under other identities like Turkish nationalism, but on the other hand, it's a move of just trying to marginalize and make it sort of less relevant that these kind of dissentient religious communities, which is actually the next question I will ask you about, like their relevance in the historiography or in the history of the Middle East.
Right. So basically, good Turks but bad Muslims. So they play a key role in the constructed nationalist narrative of the early 20th century. They are the carriers of some uncontaminated core Turkish culture, right? It's almost like they sacrifice their religion for the preservation of their ethnic identities. You know, this whole idea that Alevis are the true Turks and they remain loyal to their pre-Islamic religions and cultures, even after they converted nominally to Islam. So from the perspective of their religious beliefs and ideas, they are really not a group to be taken seriously because it's all about, you know, it's just a contamination, a decadent form of Islam, right? But they definitely are important for the construction of a Turkish nationalist narrative that sort of establishes a direct line between Central Asia and the Turks of Central Asia and Anatolia and the Turks of Turkey. And of course, here, what I have in mind is mostly, you know, like that whole historiography that starts with Köprülü, right?
Sure. Yes, the Köprülü paradigm and sort of telling of, I guess, Turkish history sometime in the 1930s and 40s as it's being constructed.
Right.
So then, I mean, something I pinned in your previous response and while reading your book is your objection to the use of the term syncretism. And your preference for the term dissentient religious communities. Can you tell us a little bit more about the tensions surrounding the notion of syncretism and why you prefer to sort of call Alevis a dissentient religious community?
Right. So, you know, the two approaches or paradigms in the historiography, in the existing historiography through which Kızılbaşism has been viewed conventionally, they are united in relegating this tradition, the Kızılbaş Alevi tradition, to the world of a timeless syncretism and allow for little of the generalization necessary for a positive line of historical inquiry. So basically, you know, the Kızılbaş Alevis end up with, you know, like as one of those people with no history, right? So it's in that sense that I have problems with syncretism. But let me be clear here. You know, what I'm disputing is not the existence of syncretic processes in the making of Kızılbaşism or in other religious or cultural traditions for that matter. Because, you know, historians know that this is how history operates, right? Religious and cultural traditions, they build on each other. They mix and match. So syncretic processes are an integral part of history for all groups. What I find problematic is the ahistorical application of this concept of religious syncretism and it's used as a taxonomical tool to differentiate between, you know, hybrid and supposedly pure traditions. You know that, and for a long time, you know, and still true today, you know, a lot of people would treat syncretism as the defining characteristic of Kızılbaşism or Alevism, even though all religions have composite origins. So that is what I find problematic. And then once you identify a tradition as syncretistic, then you can start dissecting it into its smaller parts and to trace them back to some imagined pure ethnic or religious generative source. But then what ends up happening in all these studies is that we really get very little idea about the whole, about the greater whole, and how it was maintained over the centuries, what it meant to its adherents, so on and so forth. So then what I'm saying is that when used ahistorically and as a taxonomical tool to differentiate between pure and decadent counterpart, pure traditions and their decadent counterparts, supposedly, the concept of syncretism, first of all, loses much of its analytical and explanatory power, but also turns into an othering term that serves to validate the hegemony of the self-acclaimed custodians of normativity. In other words, it's not an analytical concern that is at stake here. There are issues of power involved in singling out certain religious traditions as syncretistic, when in reality, all religions, as I said before, have composite historical origins. So I try to use a more neutral term, dissentient. So, I mean, one can think of probably better terms, but that was sort of the motivation behind using that term in place of syncretism. Yeah.
It seems to me that dissentient is a word that can sort of counteract the flattening of Alevi history that is done by the sort of taxonomic employment of the term syncretism, as you are just describing. And so and I think this is something that you do so well in your book, which is giving a sort of social history of Alevism, right? This is not about sort of like giving a description of who the Alevis are, even though this is how we started our conversation. Your book is really about telling the history of the sort of rise and transformation of Alevism. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Anatolia, the home of Alevism in the 15th and 16th centuries, as well as sort of Ottoman rule during this time, and how Kızılbaşism arises out of this context, because I think this is exactly where like the term dissentient to me makes a lot of sense in reference to Alevi history and describing Alevi communities.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that, because I never felt fully comfortable about that term, but I just couldn't come up with anything better. So it's great if it makes sense to the readers. But yeah, so for the you know, where the Kızılbaş, where it all started, right? So I clearly trace it back to the Kızılbaş movement of the second half of the 15th and early 16th centuries. But what I try to do in my book is to reconceptualize the Kızılbaş milieu or the Kızılbaş movement as a coalition of separate but interconnected Sufi and Dervish groups and related Seyyid families. These Sufi and Dervish groups, they did share certain things in common in terms of their modes of piety, such as, I don't know, like a pronounced esoteric and Alid orientation, and also a tacit rejection of the strictly textual authority of legalist Islam, and you know, this emphasis on charisma as a source of authority, so on and so forth. But in the end, these were groups with their own autonomous spheres of influence, right? And then they would come together and form a coalition under the leadership of the Safavid family. Now, the way I envision the Kızılbaş milieu stands in contrast to the conventional image of the Kızılbaş movement as an amorphous collection of tribes, basically, and more specifically, semi-Islamized Turkmen tribes. So I'm basically challenging that conventional image and, you know, reconceptualizing the Kızılbaş milieu. Now, where did these groups come from is, of course, an important question here. These Sufi and Dervish groups. These were clearly extensions or offshoots of migrant Sufis and Dervishes who hailed from more established centers of Islam in the East and settled in the frontier region of Anatolia, starting from the early 1200s onwards. It's well known from studies, like for example, by, you know, Cemal Kafadar's book. You know, we know very well that the religious and sociocultural landscape of Anatolia during the four centuries between the initial arrival of the Seljuks and the entrenchment of Ottoman rule circa 1500 was extraordinarily complex and fluid. Islam specifically was represented by groups of not only diverse ethnic and social backgrounds, but also with various religious orientations and temperaments, ranging from medrese-centered Sunni juridical Islam to normative tariqa Sufism and antinomian dervish piety with Shi'i and Alid tinges. And of course, you know, these groups then would commingle and cross-pollinate with an equally heterogeneous indigenous Christian population, right? But of these diverse groups, I think the Sufis and the Dervishes played a particularly important role in many different ways. They were, to begin with, they were the most effective proselytizers. They, as such, served as the driving force of Islamization and even Turkification, because we also sort of know that they contributed significantly to the development of a literary culture in Western Turkish, right? And in the political arena too, they were important players, bestowing religious legitimacy on the frontier warriors, the local dynasties, you know, these Turco-Muslim principalities that covered the entire political map of the region following the waning of Mongol political control. And the Ottomans were definitely one of those local dynasties on the receiving end of this support, right? And they competed for the support of these dervish groups and Sufi groups, and they patronized them in turn. And, you know, like the famous story of Sheikh Edebali, you know, and his famous dream that is one of the founding myths of the Ottomans. But then over time, again, it's pretty well known that with the Ottoman state's gradual transformation from a frontier principality into a centralist autocracy, these more radical non-conformist dervish groups such as the Abdals of Rum. I mean, the Abdals of Rum, I think, are really key here. So these groups who were partners in the early Ottoman enterprise, if you will, they would be marginalized both politically and religiously. Relations between these dervish groups and Sufi groups in the House of Osman actually was already severely fractured by the reign of Mehmed II, but they would take a turn for the worse in the wake of the Safavids' ascent to power in neighboring Persia. The latter, of course, functioned as a vortex, pulling in these groups who were alienated from the burgeoning imperial order. So, like, of everything that I have said here, really my original contribution, I guess I can say, is what I say about the pre-Safavid proto-Kızılbaş milieu, I guess. So what I try to show is that the Kızılbaş milieu was not an entirely Safavid creation, but had an autonomous and prior existence grounded in a cluster of separate but interconnected Sufi and dervish groups and related Sayyid families. But, you know, they would come together, form a coalition under the leadership of the Safavid Dudman, right, the Safavid household. And of course, the Safavid leadership was crucial in bringing these groups together, but also in the longer term, in the crystallization and consolidation of a Kızılbaş identity, an overarching Kızılbaş identity. Yeah.
Thank you for this response, which contextualizes for our listeners really well how sort of like Anatolia in this period became a place that was conducive to the rise of a movement like Kızılbaşism and Alevism. And something that I wanted to ask you in as a follow-up to this question has to do with the rivalry between the Ottomans and the Safavids. So now we know that sort of the Alevism is not, we cannot say that like it's directly linked to the Safavid movement, but at the same time, there is a sort of like milieu, right, in which there's an intense rivalry between the Ottoman Empire of Selim I and the Safavid Empire of Shah Ismail. And in this milieu, we see a lot of, your work shows that we see a lot of activity in terms of the social organization of the Alevis. So I wanted to ask you if you would clarify a little bit about how the movement is responding to the kinds of imperial formations that are taking place in around them and centralizing rule around them.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, ultimately, the growing tensions between the Ottoman household and these sort of radical dervish groups and other Sufi movements, it was directly related to growing centralization and growing orthodoxization of the Ottoman state. So that is clearly true. Of course, you know, there is a broader context to it. So we have the Mongol period, right? And in addition to that, the frontier character of Asia Minor, and also as Ahmet Kara Mustafa has really nicely demonstrated, this is a time period within Sufi history. It's a period of what Ahmet Kara Mustafa calls second renunciatory movements, like these dervish movements. They sort of are revived, these very radical antinomian dervish movements. And the Abdals of Rum were really a part of that as well. But then what will happen is with the coming of the conventional age, I guess, you know, the growing imperial rivalries and, you know, this whole idea of the end of times and a world empire emerging and so on and so forth. So what happens is we see the emergence of these highly centralizing imperial structures, and they try to homogenize, define a particular orthodoxy, and then homogenize their subject populations along the lines of that one sort of rigidly defined orthodoxy. So a lot of these groups will not find the kind of room that they had in this earlier periods to exist and to flourish. So there are all these sort of broader developments that we need to take into account. In terms of like the Ottoman-Safavid conflict, so the Safavids emerge at a time when all these ideas are floating in the air that, you know, this is the end of times and there will be one single world empire. And the Safavids come into the scene with a very powerful claim to legitimacy, both religiously and charismatically. And of course, for the Ottomans, this is very threatening. You know, as Cornel Fletcher puts very nicely, we tend to take the Ottomans for granted, and we tend to take it for granted that their legitimacy was uncontested from the very beginning. But that is obviously not true, because the Ottomans actually had ideologically and religiously really weak claims to legitimacy. They were not descendants of Genghis, right? That would sort of give them a legitimacy from a Turco-Mongol, from the perspective of Turco-Mongol traditions. They did not have any religious legitimacy. They were not Sayyids or, you know, they were just some Ghazis, right? But then, you know, when the Safavids come to the scene, you know, they were Sayyids, at least they were believed to be Sayyids, and they headed one of the most popular Sufi orders, right, during the Mongol period. So definitely the Ottomans felt the threat of that. And then all these groups, Sufi and Dervish groups, they saw the Safavids as an alternative to the Ottomans, obviously. But there's one important thing here, an important nuance that I want to emphasize here. From the perspective of the sort of Alevi Ocak system, I should say, the Safavids are technically just another charismatic family line, another Sayyid family. So the leadership of the Safavids within this Kızılbaş milieu is like number one among equals kind of a thing, right? So because all these Sufi dervish groups and Sayyid families, they had their own sort of charismas, and they also believed that they were either Sayyids or came from Sheikhli families. So the Kızılbaş, the Safavid control over this Kızılbaş milieu was in no way absolute and non-negotiated. Because that there is also that whole misconception that somehow, you know, the Kızılbaş believed that Shah İsmail was God or the Safavids were God. You know, they're attributed this sort of very crude and naive understanding of messianism, even though our sources does not confirm it. It was much more fluid than that. It was And even the Safavid leadership was open to negotiation. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I...
No, I think you definitely are, because, I mean, you brought the whole thing together with the Ojak system, which I think, it makes a lot of sense to me that Safavids, from the perspective of the Kızılbaş, represent not the sort of like great messianic appearance, but rather one of the sort of nodes of the much larger Ojak system, albeit being a very strong one, right?
Right. Or maybe forerunners. I mean, messianism is not entirely absent, but, to the extent we can see in the existing sources, the Safavids, if anything, were seen as forerunners of the Messiah, or, so there's still that whole broader context of the confessional age. But it's actually, I think the Safavids in many ways is quite similar to the Ottomans and their state building process and their ideologies. And I try to explain that in my book, what I mean with that. There are, of course, differences too, but yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Then I guess I have like two interconnected questions. One is about your exploration and sort of explanation of the Ojak system, where you, I think, do a lot of work in putting together networks whose sources are at the same time like incredibly decentralized. So I guess like I'm both asking about the Ojak networks and how they function in the social history of Alevism, but also about your research. How did you come to sort of find the sources that allow you to comment on the ways in which like Alevis were networked in the 16th century Ottoman context when, this kind of research had not been done before?
Right. Okay. So I see two questions here, right?
Yes.
One is on the Ojak systems and the other, the sources, I guess. So in terms of the Ojak system, for a long time, the Kızılbaş communities were imagined to be this a nebulous collection of tribes devoid of any identifiable religious structures. But then there was an Alevi cultural revival around the turn of the 1990s. And since then, this myth has been dispelled, basically. And now we know we know a lot about the traditional community organization of the Kızılbaş Alevis. This was clearly a genealogically based socio-religious organization centered on a group of charismatic family lines known as Ojaks. So basically what I tried to do was, okay, here we have a system, a model for some socio-religious organization. Where did this come from, right? How was it formed? And what are the sort of its genealogies, if you will. But just for those of, for our listeners who may not be familiar with the Ojak system, just very briefly, each Alevi community, whether defined on the basis of a village or a tribe or a subsection of either of the two, is attached to a particular ojak, a saint lineage, if you will. And members of these ojaks are believed to be of Sayyid ancestry through the progeny of Ali and Fatima. And members of these ojaks are called dedes or pirs, and they fulfill liturgical, judicial, and educational functions. So this like you said, highly decentralized and flexible configuration of authority, binding together saintly families and convents, Sufi convents, in a loose hierarchy, seems to have generated and successfully sustained a distinct Kızılbaş Alevi collectivity over the centuries. Actually, even today, the internal definition of the community's external boundaries still rests on the memory of this Alevi Ocak network, because their affiliates, their descendants qualify as members of the in-group simply by virtue of being born into an Alevi family, even though a majority of Alevis live secular lives today and they don't necessarily practice any of the rituals, right? So the ojaks, it appeared to me, I really did not want to work with the elusive and historically hard to document religious ideas and ritual practices, because you can, it's a very slippery slope, right? So I wanted something more concrete. And I thought that the ojaks would be a good lens through which to investigate the historical origins of this milieu. So what I tried to do was I actually studied individual ojak families based on their own family documents, and in virtually all cases, I was able to trace their family histories back to the Sufi milieu, to the multi-ethnic Sufi milieu of late medieval and early modern periods, in Anatolia and of course neighboring regions like Iraq, for instance, emerged as an important area for this. But there's one thing that needs to be explained, of course, here. You know, we can't assume that, you know, the Ojak system emerged full-fledged as soon as, you know, the Kızılbaş movement formed, right? So that is one of the interesting processes that we can actually follow with these Alevi sources, and I'll say more about them, the sources found in the family archives of Dede families. So basically, just to summarize, this is what I've found. As a result of what I call in my book a process of Sayyidization, it seems that the prior Sufi affiliations of these families receded into the background, eventually fading away completely in favor of an exclusive emphasis on their Sayyid descent, real or imagined Sayyid descent. And I identify two major factors that fueled the Sayyidization process. One factor was, of course, the coming together of these families, groups, dervish groups, whatever, under the leadership of the Safavi family. And either the gradual decline in value or more likely a deliberate repression of their prior Sufi affiliations, because the Safavids did not really, as we know very well, even though the Safavids themselves came from a Sufi background, they did not tolerate Sufi groups in Safavi territory. So these groups, they had to repress, I guess, their prior Sufi affiliations. So that's one factor, the Safavids and their leadership. But the other equally important factor, I think, was the Ottoman state's persecutor policies targeting the very Sufi infrastructure of the Kızılbaş milieu. Usually when we think about Kızılbaş persecutions, we think about, the physical sort of executions and so on and so forth. But really, Kızılbaş persecutions should be thought in a much sort of wider framework. And the virtual elimination of the infrastructure of these Ocak families, of what would eventually become Ocak families, was definitely part of that process. So these two factors then together seem to have facilitated the emergence of a more homogeneous and egalitarian Ocak system as we know it today, and the eclipse of the more heterogeneous origins, Sufi origins of these families. Yeah. I hope this makes sense, but...
Yeah, absolutely. I guess to treat it in tandem with the Ocak system, but also like, the way that you went about your research is so extraordinary for Ottoman studies, because we normally, go to state archives and sort of like dredge through the countless numbers of documents that are found, say, in the Istanbul archives or various other sort of centralized places. But reading your book, it was clear that like you actually did a lot of, what I would call ethnographic work, I don't know if you would call it that, in order to reach the sort of Dede family, these Dede families and to ask for their documents. And then these were making up the majority of the sources that you consulted to sort of, I don't know if it's majority, to be honest, but like they really make up the, I think, bulwark of your argument. So I wanted to ask you about your research process and sort of, yeah, how did it go? How did you do it?
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you for this question. Yes, in fact, I personally did not expect that I would use so many of these private archives. To be honest with you, I just wanted to spice up my source base a little bit. My original expectation was that I would, for the most part, rely on Ottoman archival sources. But then, when this Alevi cultural revival took place in the early 1990s, people started publishing a lot of books for the popular audience, and it was in those publications that I first encountered that I first became aware of the existence of such documents, and I was intrigued, and initially through some family connections, but then eventually just going and visiting villages, I sort of, established personal relationships with these families. It took me a while to gain their confidence, even though, I come from an Alevi background myself. That in and of itself is not sufficient, obviously, for these families to share with you their private archives. Because, these are sources that have been preserved in these family archives for generations and protected from the gaze of outsiders for a long time, for fear that something would happen to them, they would get confiscated by the state, so on and so forth. So, I started going to villages. I started spending pretty much all my summers, starting in 1995 even, just visiting Alevi villages. And because I was learning Ottoman, Turkish, and Arabic, I was kind of, sometimes just helping them figure out what was in their documents, family documents. Yeah, it was a long process, but I agree with you that it's a completely different experience, because you are not working simply with some written document, but you actually have real people, who value those documents, who have stories to tell, you know, about those documents and what they mean to them. And, you know, so that's how my project kind of formed almost organically. You know, I realized, you know, I have to study these documents along with the oral histories, oral traditions of the families in question. Just to give a general idea, you know, what kind of documents we have in these private archives. Well, and I collectively call them Alevi sources. And these are basically documents and manuscripts in Turkish, Arabic, and occasionally Persian, spanning from the 15th to mid-20th century, with the exception of one document from the late 14th century. It's mostly 15th, 16th century and onwards. And they comprise such genres as Sufi and Ahi ijazas, diplomas, genealogies of sainthood, ziyaret names, confirming that their holders paid visits to the Shi'i Alevi pilgrimage sites in Iraq, hilafet names granted by the Safavids, berats, fermans, hujjets issued by the Ottoman authorities, confirming their holder status as Sayyids and as dervishes, in addition to documents dealing with more mundane issues. And there are also, of course, manuscripts, collections of religious treatises and poetry and so on and so forth. Yeah, so these documents, I think just to wrap up my answer, you know, I was truly surprised to find this, you know, amazing new body of written material. And we still don't have a picture of the full extent of these sources. And I think they're not only valuable for shedding light on some fundamental aspects of Kızılbaş history that have long remained unknown in the dark, but they also force us to revise a number of well-established assumptions concerning the wider religio-political environment of pre-Ottoman Anatolia and in the early years of the Ottoman Empire, not to mention, of course, this Ottoman-Safavid conflict. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I think also you are opening the path for future researchers to explore archives that are outside of the sort of centralized state archives, which we normally make use of. So in that sense, I find this sort of ethnographic gesture, let's say, of your research to be quite inspiring, and also seeing how effective it is in undermining our assumptions. It adds to the whole to the whole value, I think, of this book for people who are interested in learning more about the methods of historical analysis, even when we are looking at the late medieval, early sort of modern Ottoman period. So yeah, that's really something I appreciated about reading the Kızılbaş Alevis in Ottoman Anatolia.
Well, and Deren, let me just add here that in the part of the world where we are from, there are so many such private archives, family archives that have not being used at all, that we don't even know about. I was surprised to find that out, even in our apartment building in Istanbul, you know, just totally unsuspected neighbors. There were like a few cases like that. They would bring to me, you know, family documents in Ottoman and ask me to read. So there is really a great potential, especially in Ottoman, Turkish studies, Anatolian, whatever, to do that kind of, you know, using family archives and doing ethnographic work. Yeah.
So I want to shift gears very a little bit to one of the major findings of your work. I mean, we've talked about so many of the challenges to accepted paradigms that you've posed, but one of the sort of major findings of your book is the historical affinity between Alevi saintly lineages with the Vafa'i Sufi tradition. So can you tell us a little bit about the Wafaiya and their relationship to the Kızılbaş Alevis and how your finding modifies our understanding of the Kızılbaş Alevi history?
Right. So yes, definitely, you know, that was the one of the most, or perhaps the most surprising discoveries that came out of my research into Alevi sources. That is the a previously little recognized widespread presence in late medieval Anatolia of the Iraqi-born Wafai or Vefai Sufi order, cutting across social, ethnic, and even sectarian divisions, and for the purposes of Alevi history, the historical affinity between this Sufi tradition and several prominent Kızılbaş Alevi ojaks. Well, not all Alevi ojaks are Vefai affiliated, but definitely a significant group centered in Eastern and Central Anatolia are, according to their own family documents. So what does that mean for future research or for our understanding of Alevi history? Well, first of all, it highlights, I think, the multi-ethnic Sufi milieu of the Middle East, or Anatolia and the neighboring regions, if you will, as the most appropriate context within which to explore genealogies of Kızılbaş Alevism. And as such, it clearly contests the long-standing Köprülü paradigm in the field, which traces the origins of the Alevi or and Bektashi tradition to the pre-Islamic Turkish culture in Central Asia. So that is really the sort of the broad takeaway here. That doesn't mean that, you know, again, that doesn't mean that there weren't anybody coming from like any Sufi groups coming from Central Asia or from Khorasan. You know, we can see that that was also part of the story, but certainly there was this very important strain of Sufi and Dervish groups coming from Iraq, especially directly to Anatolia. And the Wafaiya specifically emerges as an important component here. The Wafai Sufi tradition originated in 11th century Iraq. Its founder namesake, Abul Vefa or Ebul Vefa, was a Sayyid, according to its hagiography. And he spent most of his life among tribal Kurds in central Iraq, where he commanded an ethnically and socially diverse following. But what is, aside from this, you know, this sort of, you know, that we need to somehow shift our focus from Central Asia to Iraq, maybe, the cradle of Sufism, right? I think what really fascinated me and excited me was what I discovered about the Wafai tradition itself. Because, like, as a Sufi tradition. Now, Ebul Vefa, according to the silsila given in the Wafai diplomas, what is directly connected to one of the earliest Sufi circles in Basra in southern Iraq. And what's special about this, the Basran Sufis, is that they represented an alternative an antinomian strain within Sufism that was distinct from that of the normative Baghdadi tradition associated with the famous Junayd al-Baghdadi. And the Vefai tradition, of course, over time, as this normative Sufism came to be defined, a lot of these alternative strains within Sufism came to be marginalized and pushed beyond the pale, right? And by people like, you know, like Imam Ghazali, for instance. Now, the interesting thing about the Wafai silsila is that it reaches to one of the seminal Sufi figures, Sehl el-Tusteri. Sehl el-Tusteri was one of the two giants of early Sufism, the other one being Junayd al-Baghdadi. But interestingly enough, Sehl el-Tusteri's name is not typically encountered in Sufi silsilas. So the Wafa'i silsila is possibly the one and only Sufi line claiming an explicit and direct connection to Sehl el-Tusteri and to his Sufi circle in Basra. So that is what I really find exciting about the Wafa'i tradition. And hence the importance of the Wafa'iyya, not just for Alevi Bektashi history, but for the history of Sufism in general.
My sort of final substantive question has to do with this, the question of the persecutions of Alevis, which were sort of, we kind of touched on this. You were saying that they were not only being persecuted, of course, under the Ottomans, but also under the Safavids. But I want to ask more specifically about the Ottoman case because of the sort of, you know, the history of Sultan Selim I and the massacres of Alevis that were taking place during this time. You suggest that we ought not to perceive this history through the binaries of tolerance versus intolerance or politics versus religion. How should we then understand Alevi persecutions in the Ottoman Empire and the long-lasting legacy of these persecutions in the formation of contemporary Alevi identity?
Right. So, my answers end up being really long because your questions are really very profound questions. So in each case, I pretty much sort of end up summarizing, right, one entire chapter. Again, thank you for this great question because there is this very common assumption about some inherent Ottoman administrative pragmatism and religious tolerance. And this assumption also shapes the conventional thinking about Kızılbaş persecutions, that, you know, they were simply localized and historically particular exceptions to this norm of Ottoman tolerance propelled essentially by security concerns and by political motivations and not religious motivations. But, you know, there are a lot of problems with this line of thinking. First of all, you know, a de facto pluralism and tolerance should not be confused with a principled commitment to the toleration of religious difference, right? Because we know that, like other persecuting states, the Ottomans were ready and capable to employ coercive power whenever they felt necessary to secure external religious conformity. Also, you know, persecution does not need to be universal or end in extermination to be effective. You know, so long as the threat or fear of persecution is periodically validated and reinforced, then, you know, you can control people's behaviors. So tolerance and intolerance are not mutually exclusive categories. They often coexist, right? And even require each other to be meaningful. The same false binaries established between religious and political motivation, as if one precludes the other, even though, like, especially in the context of the 16th century, you know, separating the political from the religious. I mean, is that even possible? You know, would be my question. But that's sort of my broader comments, right? More specifically, what I critique in my book is to treat Kızılbaş persecutions as an inevitable and unmediated and self-explanatory outcome of the Ottoman Safavid rivalry. You know, this whole story about how the Safavids posed an existentialist challenge to the Ottomans and acted on the basis of some grand strategy to expand into Anatolia, even though evidence in that regard is actually pretty weak. But this logic of inevitability obscures many things. That first of all, that it was a policy choice on the part of Selim, to replace his father's more moderate sort of carrot stick policy with active persecution. That was a policy choice, right? And this policy choice was closely related to the intra-dynastic rivalry and civil war in the years leading up to Selim's ascent to power in 1512, right? So we need to remember that. So it was not inevitable. It was a choice. But I also argue that the continuing relevance of confessional politics that was inaugurated with Selim's ascent to power, its continuing relevance also need to be explained. And I think this can or should be explained within the context of a fundamental ideological and structural shift in the Ottoman Empire during this period, which I, along with some other historians, call Sunni confessionalization, which brought about a major reconfiguration of Ottoman dynastic self-identification and imperial politics. And so the othering of the Kızılbaş and their exclusion from the Ottoman policy then was key to the consolidation and perpetuation of the empire's Sharia-centered Sunni identity upon which the dynasty came to recast its legitimizing ideology. So to put it differently, then, the repressive measures against the Kızılbaş emerged not as simple security measures, but rather as a factor in Sunni confessionalization and as a performance of Sunni hegemony. Another point that I emphasize in this context is the long-term consequences of this confessional turn in Ottoman politics. What I try to show is how these persecutory measures against the Kızılbaş worked together with the Ottoman state's Sunnitization policies to create greater confessional uniformity and conformity in the empire, right? It wasn't only the Kızılbaş who were impacted by the by these policies. It was the larger Muslim polity, right? And this homogenization then resulted in a greater moral integration of Sunni Muslims with the Ottoman states. But then on the flip side, of course, these same policies amplified confessional polarization and animosity, both at the official and popular levels. And as you well know, the effects of these are still evident in the Turkish society today, right? You know, the Sunni, Alevi-Sunni cleavage being probably the most unsurmountable cleavage still in the Turkish society today.
Thank you. Thank you for your answer.
Well, can I just add one more thing? According to the original confessionalization theory, there is a close relationship between confessionalization, religious confessionalization, and modern state building processes. You know, this sort of stands in contrast to earlier ideas about the emergence of the modern state, which, you know, people thought went hand in hand with secularization. But, you know, like the confessionalization theory says the opposite, that somehow modern national identities and modern states are actually products of these confessionalization processes. And this really fits with the case of the Ottoman Empire and modern Turkey. And we see this in the in this really close entanglement of the Turkish identity with the Sunni identity, right? Still, you know, in the Ottoman Empire, after this period, it was this is the Sunni identity. Those were sort of the kind of subjects that the Ottoman Empire tried to create and promote. And in modern Turkey, even though the state became technically and formally secular, because of this sort of historical and inherent connection between the Turkish identity and Sunni Islam, you know, in practice, we know that this formal secularism has not really changed a lot, or not everything, I guess, and the confessional boundaries, the cleavage is still very relevant because of that. Yeah.
Before we go out, Ayfer, I want to ask, what are you working on these days?
Oh, well, yeah, I'm working on a lot of different things, as is typical with academics. Well, I'm still receiving new documents. Actually, nowadays, it's so much easier. Everybody knows me now, and people just scan their family documents and email them to me. Currently, I'm working on a family, an Ocak family, whose historical origins seems to lie in the Nurbakhshi Sufi tradition. So that's sort of one thing that I'm working on. Another sort of big long-term project that I'm thinking about and planning these days is the creation of a digital Alevi archive that hopefully one day will bring together and make available online for other researchers these family documents and manuscripts. And finally, this is actually my second book project. Since graduate school, in addition to my work on the Kızılbaş Alevi communities, I've also had an abiding interest in women's history and gender studies. And so in my next book, I would like to venture into areas of research where I can combine my interest in gender studies and non-conformist religious currents in the Ottoman Empire, and to explore notions of heterodoxy and orthodoxy and their gendered constructions, using primarily Sufi hagiographies. I even have a provisional title for my book. Gender and Heresy, Constructions of Femininity and Masculinity in Late Medieval Sufi Hagiographies. These are all the kind of stuff that I hope I'll be working on.
Yeah, that all sounds so exciting, especially, I mean, I really look forward to how you will bring together gender history and gendered analysis with the studies of these hagiographies. It's been a wonderful pleasure to talk to you about your book, The Kızılbaş Alevis in Ottoman Anatolia, Sufism, Politics, and Community. I urge all of you to check out Ayfer's book. It is a great read for experts and novices alike. It's out from Edinburgh University Press. Yeah, thank you, Ayfer, and goodbye for now.
All right. Thank you, Deren. This was really great. Thank you. I enjoyed it.